My name is Jan Christian Markevich, and I'm a program manager working on the Windows Core Experience team. I moved from Norway to Redmond to work on Windows about 6 years ago. And then Windows 8, I've been working on personality and the interaction model for the Metro style apps. That's what I'm going to talk about today. So how many people have installed the Windows 8 build and play with it? Cool. Sweet. How many people have built apps? No, it's not bad. How many people have built HTML5 apps? And XAML? XAML, cool. Sweet. So Metro-style apps, they're a pretty dramatic shift from what we've seen before. And today I'm going to talk a lot about some of the steps you can take making sure that your app actually becomes what we would call and define as a Metro-style app. So before I deep dive into that, I actually want to take us back a couple of years when we started the Windows 8 development process. And we do a lot of usability studies at Microsoft and at Windows, of course. So but we don't just do like the technical ones where they just, can they complete this task? We also do a lot of usability studies on the feel of it. Do people like it? Do they love it? Do they hate it? And what can we do to improve there? So in one of these tasks, we actually had them come in and we asked them to draw Windows 7. And this is the sketch we would get pretty consistently from everyone, right? And it's as expected. It's like you see the taskbar at the bottom, you have the window and the controls, and that's what we refer to as the Chrome around the app. So we did that. Sweet clicker. And then we showed them some Metro style apps, what we thought was apps that embodied Metro style. And they completed a bunch of functional tasks, so they didn't know what we were actually testing them on. They thought we were just checking if they could actually complete the task. They would complete the task, answer a bunch of questions about what they liked, what they didn't like, and then we asked them to draw again. And now they drew this. Do you see the difference? So in this one, all they actually drew is Chrome. There's no interesting thing here. It's all stuff you need to be able to actually do interesting stuff. And this one, it's all content. These boxes represent your content. That's what they remembered. So when people use your app, they don't do it because they think your close button is awesome or because the OK button is so beautiful, right? And that's what they remembered here. They do it to actually get to content and complete their tasks. And that's what Metro-style apps are all about. So if you use Metro-style design, you can make your apps really great at content. And this is what I'm going to focus on today because this is what I think is really cool about Metro-style. And there's a couple of ways you can do that. And if we put them in kind of our big main ways of doing that, there's three of them. So you can reduce the Chrome to put focus on the content, which makes sense. The less stuff that's in the way of your actual content, the more focus you'll have on the content, right? So it's just about reducing the stuff that's not that useful so you can have focus on the stuff that people care about. The second thing is you can use all the cool new stuff in Windows 8 to actually enhance your content. We have the contracts and all that stuff, and I'll cover that. And finally, how many people have more than one main computer that they'll use a lot? Is that right? Yeah. So if it's all about content and we all use different computers, we need to make sure we can actually access that content in a good way as we switch computers. So reducing Chrome sounds easy, but we need to think about how we do this. Because there's a reason we have Chrome, right? It creates some structure. It lets you have controls and stuff like that. So we can't just remove it and just like, oh, we're done. Here's the picture, right? We need to really think about it. And there's three really useful tools we can use as we remove a lot of the like visual Chrome that's on the screen. We can use layout, we can use typography, and we can use the grid. And this is all really inspired from what we call Swiss design, which if you've been at airports and stuff like that, you see that they always have very clear and crisp signs that show you it's all about the content, right? They don't care about having a really nice background or something here. It's really about, I need to know where the departures are so I can get there fast. So in terms of layout, we can remove the lines and boxes. And stop using that as a way to group content, and instead use layout. Instead of having a lot of visual flair, like gradients and shadow effects, try to keep your elements crisp so they actually focus on the content itself and not the adornments you put on them. And finally, use white space in a thoughtful way to actually create some clarity of your system. So let's look at a quick example here. So this is something you would think of as a normal Windows 7 style app, right? It's a news example of a newsfeed reader. So I have my list of feeds, I have my sublist of feeds, and this is my content. I opened this app to read this. And this is a little extreme smaller. You can make it a little bigger, but it's still a huge chunk of your app that goes to the thing that's not the main thing of the app. This is the thing of the app, right? So let's try to remove some of these lines here. So we have a lot of lines here and everywhere, and they kind of detract from the thing we want to focus on. So now we use the crisp visual elements here, where we actually use the color on the top to actually fade away a little bit of that, because that doesn't matter. And you can argue that all the stuff within white is actual content, because the RSS feeds are also content. They're just kind of very high-level content. It's not the detailed content. Well, let's take it one step further. Let's bring the real content to the foreground, right? So now it's all about content. And you use white space to create breathing room here. So that doesn't have to be boring with a gray background. You can actually do a lot of things here. And that's something in general for all of Metro-style design. Don't think about it as really hard rules that it has to be exactly like this. These are principles. And principles mean that you have room to play with it. So in this case, this app is all about my weather. So it has a really rich background, which shows me the an indication of the weather in Redmond right now. It never rains in Redmond. It's a lie. This is actually gets really, it becomes really engaging, right? Because it's a nice full-blooded experience. And it doesn't have to be boring and just boxes and just like single-colored backgrounds. But again, it's about the content. Don't put a random pattern in the background, because that doesn't add any value. Here's another example of using white space. So the real content is really the album that's being played and my timeline. But look at the interest we create here by just having a little bit of content at the bottom here to create this white space. It makes it really makes it help focus on the content on the top by having this as just kind of a border at the bottom, and use the white space to move your focus up. So that was quickly about layout. So next thing I want to talk about is the grid. Oh, sorry, the typography. So as I said, Metro style is based on Swiss modern design, and typography is a huge portion of that. So it's all about clean, beautiful typography. But the interesting thing is you can create structure with typography. And we do this by using what we call the type ramp. And this is the type ramp. So it might seem limiting, but we have only four sizes, and they all have slightly different weights. But with this, you can create a really nice structure in your app. So you can use the bigger, more bold text to actually use it for your headers. So it gives you a clear structure that this is like the main header of this app. And then you use the subheaders to indicate that these are the next important part of the app. So you create the sense of hierarchy using typography. So let's look at an example here. So you see on the top, this is actually from the Visual Studio templates. I assume you guys have seen them since you build apps. So the Visual Studio templates all embody the use of layout and typography. So the top header there is using the largest font type we use. And then there's clear structure that this is the second most important thing there. And then we actually use click. There you go. And then we use the third size, the 11 point, to indicate the next level of hierarchy. So now you can also use weight within these. So the header of this thing is made bold, so you can see that this is the header and this is the actual text of the feed, or whatever it is. And then the final one was the clicker is not working very well. The final 9 point is for the tertiary information that's less important. So using these font weight, we can actually create structure, right? So we don't have to have boxes to create structure. We can do it with font weight. And it's just another representation of it showing how we only have four sizes and the different weights within them. That's all you need to create really beautiful layouts. So now we get this question a lot. We use Segoe UI a lot, which is the Windows Metro style font that we provide. Can I use something else? Yes, you can use whatever font you want, but the principle is that you have a type ramp. So here we have the biggest one for the header, and then we have the next three levels. So you can use whatever font you want. Just like Metro style design, it's not a hard rule, it's a principle. It's the principle of using a type ramp. So as long as you use a type ramp, you can use any font you want. So use your font type ramp to create structure. The next thing you can use to create structure, once you have your content, is how you place it on the actual canvas. And to help you with that, we have what we call the grid. I think I'll give up on this. So the grid basically helps you place your content on your canvas so that it's in a clear, readable way. We don't show any visible grid lines, so it's called a grid. And I'll show you a lot of pictures of grid lines. But these are just to help us align stuff. We never show them in our app. And then you can use proportions in the grid to imply hierarchy. So this is the grid. And this is also based on typography again. The grid is something that was used heavily in Swiss modern design. The grid consists of, this is the main grid. So this is a grid unit, which is 20 pixels by 20 pixels. This has subunits, which are 5 pixels. So everything we put in our apps, we put on the grid. And I'll show you a little bit more how you place it on the grid. We have some guidelines for that as well. And then we define everything as multiples of the subunits. So the column spacing is actually 4 of the units, right? So since this is based on the typography grid, or the typography, the grid actually puts all the content, all the text bottom aligned with the grid. So why do we do that? Well, if we do that, it's really clear to see that these are heavier because they all have the same baseline. If they're just like jumbled across the screen, it's hard to know which one really should have the most focus. So all our grids, they're anchored to the, well, all our element on the grids, they're anchored to the top left edge. And you can see here, it's easier to show here. The screen's too big for me. So this text is on the grid line. So the big gray lines are the main grid, the 20 by 20 pixels. And you can see how this type starts at the bottom of the of this grid line. And it's also aligned to the left on the grid line. The same thing with the content that starts underneath. And now, as we apply this grid everywhere else, we use it for padding between elements as well. So we use the sub we use two subunits to differentiate between the hard edge objects within the group. So this is used consistently across the whole thing here. You can see all these spaces are the same. But then we use the whole column to separate the groups from each other, right? So now it's really clear that this content belongs together. And this content belongs together. There's no line on the screen. Well, there's a ton of lines, but they're not going to be visible in the app. And then the page header, we use a baseline, which is 5 units from the top. And then we left line with the margin, which is like 6 units. So now the interesting thing, so this is our app we looked at earlier. So we did this. But now if we apply the same grid to it, and use the same spacing, you can see how we have this clear differentiation that these are groups that belong together. The second group over there, this header clearly belongs to this because it's a little bit closer, and everything is nicely aligned. You can see how Design Milk and Core 77, they're all on the same grid line all along. There you go. So we removed all the lines, but we still have structure, right? And that's by applying the grid. And that's why people remember this, because they're focused on the content instead of all the lines around. So now, again, Metro style principles. doesn't mean that everything has to look the same. These are actually very different, but they all follow the grid. So we have the Newsfeeder app, Tweeterama, Socialite, and like a Stocks app. They all follow the grid. They all have the same alignment for the text here. Socialite doesn't even have the subheaders. Doesn't need them. But it uses this to put the next level of content in there. So it has the big, nice pictures there, right? Think about this in terms of the silhouette of a Metro-style app. So we have the silhouette of the Windows 7 system with the taskbar at the bottom. This is our new silhouette. It's kind of C-shaped, where like there's open space here, like this, and then your content just flows. So these are just some examples from the templates. So in Visual Studio, all layout, typography, and the grid, they're all built into the templates. Use these as starting points. Feel free to explore, try different things. Just follow the principles of layout and grid and layout, grid, and typography. So these are just other examples, and they all follow the same kind of pattern here. But again, use your imagination and think about different ways of putting this together, right? You can use size and proportion to create different weights. They're all following the grid again. Or you can use positioning to do it differently. When you think about your like all those pages I showed, think about them as your magazine layout. Like these are like the showcase way to show your app. And all these layouts, they're all Rolling Stones. They're all clearly distinguishable as being Rolling Stone because they all have they actually have like their header consistently placed. Sometimes there's stuff sticking over it, sometimes not. But there's clear focus on the actual content, but you know that Rolling Stone is on the top there. And they also use white space a lot to create interest, so like you don't have to cram stuff everywhere. Leave a little bit of white space. There's another example of Wired again. So, I mean, in print, they've used these principles a lot, and it's actually really the whole. When you're looking at all the magazines and the newsstand, they need to kind of show you the content first because that's why you're buying the magazine. So they're really good at this. So you know that the middle one, this magazine has interesting stuff about Pixar and how they build the movies. So if you're interested in that, you know to go and read that magazine. They really only have like a fraction of a second to get your attention, so they need to show the important stuff and not just Chrome everywhere. So it's just another example of how this is very different from the ones I showed before, but just using different sorts of weights and create interest in the layout, but still following the same grid. The text shouldn't go down there. I think my PowerPoint got messed up. Cool. So that was a very quick overview of using those three tools. So using the layout and typography and the grid. The next thing I want to talk about is the Metro-style input languages. So having all the nice stuff on the screen is nice, right? But doesn't help anything if you can't interact with it. And that's typically a case where it's very easy to fall into the trap of just like, oh, I need buttons for this, I need controls for all that. But the Metro-style design languages are actually designed in such a way that we can limit the Chrome on the screen. So let's start looking at the mouse. So mouse is great. We're a touch-first system, but we still love mouse and keyboard. It's just a different input method. Touch is direct, it's really nice when you're sitting on the couch. Mouse is really efficient, and it's good and precise. It's nice to use when you're on the desk. So they're just different input methods used for different things. When we designed Metro-style, we thought about the controls you use with the mouse, and we wanted to eliminate some of the Chrome or reduce the noise of it. So you've all probably seen this before, but here's my nice start screen. There's no visible Chrome on the screen now for controlling the view using my mouse. But as soon as I move the cursor, which is when I indicate to the system I want to do something with my mouse, the scroll bar shows up. Now I can use the scroll bar. So the scroll bar is the way I scroll with mouse, but we don't have to show it all the time. We only show it when you need it. There's one simple example of how we can improve the way the input languages work. So you don't have to worry about how users are going to scroll, because the scroll bar takes care of that, but we can still make it be less in your face when you're not using it. So now, the challenging thing with touch, since we're a touch-first system, is that all touch interactions are invisible, right? You don't You don't have any way to know that you can pinch this thing, or how do you select, or how do you do stuff? And that creates a challenge. And I just want to tell a little story where when I was back in high school, I decided it would be cool to learn a little bit of sign language. So took a couple of classes, didn't last very long, just learned a couple of words. And then later when I took an exchange year in Santa Barbara at the university, I went to a party. And I started talking to this girl, and she knew sign language, so I wanted to impress her. And with my very limited knowledge of sign language, I knew how to do duck. And duck in sign language, I learned, was like this. It's like a goose or duck that moves along, right? But she just looked at me really strangely, like, what the hell are you up to? That's just crazy. So it turns out that sign language is different in English than Norwegian. So the sign for duck is this, like a beak. So we both had the same meaning we wanted to convey, but we had a different symbol for doing it. So we couldn't communicate. And I also looked like a fool doing this. But so that's really a big challenge with touch. But the way we set to solve this in Windows was by creating a touch language. So instead of just having apps do random stuff, we created a language. And that's really useful because now if everybody follows this language, I can't just communicate with one app or like a few apps. I can create with I can actually communicate with every app, and I know how they all work. So I don't have to relearn every time I go into a new app how to do stuff. And this is typically a place where people would fall onto the crutch of Chrome. Because if you don't think that people know how to select, I'm going to put a select button on every element, right? That's a safe way of doing it. But now with Windows 8, we promise that users will know how to select because it's a core part of the touch language. To do stuff on the start screen, you need to know how to select. So if you use our touch language, your app will be intuitive and more enjoyable to use because people will know how to use it. And the touch language is very simple. Kai did a talk about the touch language and details about how we actually got to the touch language. How many people went to Kai's talk? Cool. If you didn't go to it, I recommend watching it. It's on the Build website, the video from the Build conference as well. It goes into details about the usability research and why we did this. And it's really interesting. And I'm also in that one. So it's very simple. Only 8 interactions. That's all you need. So we have press and hold to learn, tap for primary action, slide around to pan. We have swipe to select, and I'll demo all these. Pinch and stretch to zoom, turn to rotate, and then we have the 2 edge interactions from the top or bottom for your app, or from the left or right for system stuff. So let's take a quick look at this. So this is my start screen. Just touch down, and I can start sliding around. So this is a great way to interact with content first. So all this leverages the concept of direct manipulation. And that's another way to get rid of Chrome. So instead of having a huge touch scroll bar, I just grab the content and move it around where I want to move it, so I don't need to have a lot of Chrome on the screen. We have a tiny little scrolling indicator at the bottom because it's useful to know where you are on the screen. But as soon as you're done scrolling, it actually just goes away because it's not useful anymore. Might be a little hard to see, but it's at the bottom there. The other thing with sliding for panning your content is that touch is usually it's very sloppy in the sense that it's hard to do the slide exactly the same time every time. So you notice that I have all these groups that are separated using our awesome grid system with the column width. But we actually built a feature called proximity snap points. So for every start of these groups, we put a proximity snap point. And the reason we did that is that when I pan now, you notice how this lands perfectly nice with the start text there? That's not just because I'm awesome at panning. That's actually the system helping me. So without any effort from the user, they just think they're really good at panning, and it looks really nice. And just like small details, they make a big difference here. We also have a different way of doing these kind of snap points. So like I said, the tap is for primary action. So if I want to go to an app, I just tap. And this is my little mascot, Muck Muck, who came traveling. So if I want to go back and forward, all I have to do is drag the content to the left or right, and I can actually go back in my history stack of my web page. So again, I don't have to have a back button for my browser on the screen all the time, because I can use direct manipulation to go back and forward. And these snap points make it easy to be super sloppy. So I can just swipe really fast with my finger. I don't have to get it perfectly aligned. It will always make sure it aligns for me. So this one is what we call mandatory. So we'll force it to land on one or the other side. Well, the other one is the proximity-based one, which will let me land nicely when I toss it, but I'm still in full control, and if I really want to leave it that way, that's fine. So that's the difference there. So that's more to make the user just feel a little better when they're doing it, but not forcing them to stay within the page-by-page view. So a couple of important things as I touch down there to launch my app is that we have down feedback as soon as my finger comes down. So you see how the tile does a little shrink and tilt? And if I go into an app, same thing. So this is really important because it gives me feedback that my content and my screen is reacting, so I know what's going on. And that's one thing that's really easy to just forget about because we're not used to that being as important as it is with touch. Another interaction we have is hold to learn in touch language. So here's an example of that where if I hold on this thing because I don't know exactly what it means, we actually display this little tooltip. And this is something we're used to having with mouse, but that kind of disappeared when we got into touch because there's no hover state. But by just holding on it now, I can actually get this information, and I can actually scrub between these to learn what they mean, and I can drag off to cancel. So that's one example of hold to learn. Hold to learn is also really useful for the next interaction I'm going to show, which is selection. So to select something, I just hold, and it teaches me. So I hold to learn, and I saw a little jump down there, right? So that's a little indicator that I need to drag down to select. I see the check mark being revealed from under my item, and I just lift. And this is the touch-first way of selecting, and it's really designed for touch and how I can be really fast through these drags. And I can do this super fast. So I held to learn once, and now I learned it, and I can be fast for the rest of my life. I don't have to press and hold every time I want to select or do something else with the item. I just swipe. So that's why we think hold is really good for learning, but not good for commanding. So as I swipe here, I get the commands at the bottom. I can really quickly make it smaller, can really quickly make it bigger. The other thing you can do with swipe is you can actually drag down. And at this point, the item has this highlight. I can actually just drag it out and position it wherever I want. So there's no moding here. I just drag it out. I just have to drag up or down first, and then I can drag it out from the grid. And since it's a multi-touch system, I can also do stuff like this, right? So I can hold item, I can scroll. And you kind of expect touch to work that way because you have multiple fingers. Why do we limit it to mouse input? A couple of important things as you see this. It's not a gesture in the typical sense where I just flick, and then I wait, and the system does something. It's really direct manipulation. So as I hold this item and start dragging down, it follows my finger the whole time. It gives me good feedback that it's going to be selected with the highlight. But if I change my mind, I can just put it back. Nothing bad happened. It's really safe to explore. Okay. So that's the first couple of things from touch language. The next one is pinching and stretching to zoom. You guys are probably familiar with that, with the optical type of zoom. But we actually do something we call semantic zoom with that as well. And semantic zoom is really a solution for touch to do jumping in the list. So with mouse, we have a great solution with the scroll bar. But with touch, there is no scroll bar. So how do I jump really far? Well, I'll just zoom out, and then I just zoom in where I want to go. Right? And this is really fast and fluid, really easy to do. When I'm using my slate, I always have like my full hand available, so it's really easy to just pinch and do it. The reason we call it semantic zoom is because if you look at all the tiny text that's there, when we do our swap, we actually hide it. So it's not a pure optical zoom. We actually change some of the icons as well so that they're more tailored for this view instead of just being a really tiny version of the start screen. So an example of how this could be a little more obvious is on the app screen. So here I have all my apps. Sorted alphabetically. At the end, I actually have my groups of apps. So if I want to jump within this list, I just pinch, and I get the appropriate representation of the content in this view. So again, it's not just a tiny version of the programs list. It's actually something that's useful. I know I want to go to the QuickTime app or an app starting with C. I just tap, and I'm there. So the important thing with semantic zoom is that we always use pinch to invoke it. And you can pinch in to zoom in. But you can also tap to zoom in. So when you're in the semantic view, we don't really change. It's not like you're navigating away. You're really just jumping within the same content. So It's not like this takes you to something really different. It's the same content, just a different visualization that makes it more navigatable. And we don't show widely different commands either, but we do scope the commands to the right level. So when I swipe to select, normally I command on the tile, but if I swipe to select here, I actually command on the whole group. And I can actually move the whole group around as well. So because the semantics change it to a group level, that's okay. But it's not like this is, we hide functionality in the semantic view. So since we also love mouse, I'll just show this to you quickly. If you use mouse, there's a little zoom button at the bottom corner. You just tap and you zoom out, and then you just click where you want to go, which is great to throw your mouse down there, and really fast and efficient way to zoom out with mouse as well. And then we have our edge interactions. So let's start with app edge. So that's the top and bottom. So if I drag up from the bottom, we hide the extra Chrome that I usually don't need at the bottom of the screen. So that way we don't have to show an all apps button all the time. You just show it when you need it, when you swipe up. And if I go to, Internet Explorer, similar here. We don't have to show the content all the time. We just show it when you need it. So I swipe, I see commanding stuff at the bottom, and I see navigation stuff at the top. And then we have the left and right edge. So if I swipe in from the right edge, we have the consistent system charms. So these are across the system. I'm going to use the start button now to go back to start. If I'm in an app, I can swipe from the left to actually go between the apps that are open. And again, it's a really fast and fluid way to just switch between your apps. So that's a quick overview of the touch language. I covered how we use direct manipulation and the important things of that, but just to reiterate, to use direct manipulation means that there's immediate feedback when you touch down and move an object. There's no like invisible thresholds. When I drag the item to select it, as soon as I hit the selection threshold, there's good visual feedback with the rectangle. I know what's going on. Similarly, when I'm going between photos, I know I'm dragging to the right and the thing is coming from the left, and I can see what's going on. It's not like I dragged on the screen, waited for a fraction of a second, and the system interpreted it. Yeah?
Is there visual feedback when you select something and you go to scroll out of view? So you know you have something selected over there?
Yeah, so the question is, if you select something and then you scroll out of view, do you know about it? So there's one way to solve it with what we call baskets. So if you select something, you can have a basket representation at the bottom where you show what's selected. I'll just show it to you quickly. So this is in the picker. I don't know if I have any things to select here, though. Okay, so if I select this item, well, this one's only single select. So in scenarios where you have multi-select, if you select an item, we typically show an indication of what's selected down here in what we call a basket. So if this supported multi-select, everything I select shows up here, which means that when I scroll out of view, I still know stuff is selected. Was there another question? When you zoom out, we don't indicate selection in this case because it's not really, doesn't add any value. This one? No, you don't. So another way to represent that you have something selected is what we do here, where when you select, we actually show commands for the object, so you know that something is selected. So in this case, actually, when I select more than one, there's a clear selection option as well. So I just clear that, and now all my selections are gone. And the final thing about direct manipulation is that it lets interactions be reversible. So now, it feels safe to explore. With mouse, we're used to just hovering around and seeing what's going on, and we get feedback by objects reacting to the mouse cursor and tooltips. With touch, we don't have that. So it's really important that when you interact with something, it feels safe. So when I drag a tile down to select it, I get feedback of what's going on, but I could always reverse my interaction.
Can I also do these things with mouse?
So that's actually a good question. So let me show you selection with mouse. So I'm on the start screen again, and dragging down with mouse is kind of awkward, especially on trackpad, because you have to hold a button and drag down. The way we always command with mouse is by right-clicking, right? That's how you show more things about an object. So if I just right-click on it, it gets selected, and then we showed the commands immediately. So again, it's just the fastest way to do this with mouse. It's just really efficient. Mouse has two buttons, which is one of the reasons why mouse is awesome. Question? Yes. So keyboard is also, you move, just move focus around, and then you just press the space bar to select. And this one actually moves focus, but you should keep focus in the grid, and then you can just like arrow around and space for everything you want to select. So this is just examples that I have. Like with mouse and keyboard, we don't want to change stuff to just for the sake of it. Like because we drag down with touch doesn't mean that it's the best way to do it with mouse and keyboard. So right-click is a good example of how we optimize selection for both touch and for mouse, but just in different ways.
What about the zooming stuff?
So, zooming with mouse? Zooming with mouse has the button in the bottom right corner. Okay. Zooming with keyboard, again, we're not trying to reinvent things just for fun of it. So the way you always zoom out with keyboard is with control minus, so that works as well. So it's kind of like mouse and keyboard works, they work as expected, and touch has new touch-optimized interactions. Exactly, it does. Yeah. So control scroll wheel is another way to do it with mouse, because that's how you typically zoom with mouse as well. That's a good question. So Metro style apps, we lay out horizontally. Mouse wheels are typically vertical, right? So I don't have a real mouse here, but I'll show you what with the weird little trackpad thing. So my trackpad has a scroll thing up and down. So we actually map it. So if I move down, it means I want to see more content. So it just maps it to scrolling left and right. Cool. Okay. So the reason why I talk so much about direct manipulation is because it really lets us be content first. So now, instead of having a next and previous button in the browser or in my photo app, I just move the content directly. Reduces the Chrome. And it also makes it possible to have these new touch interactions be learnable. Because when I swipe down, I actually understand what's going on because there's always feedback. If it was just a swipe and then the item suddenly turned selected, it would be really hard for users to understand what's going on and actually learn the interaction. For all of our direct manipulation, we actually allow any number of fingers. So we don't differentiate if I pan with three fingers or one because it's direct manipulation. If I move this card around with one finger and three, it doesn't suddenly do something wildly different. And this is just another good way of making the system feel safe to explore and learnable. For our interactions, since we want to be a fast and fluid system, we don't want to use timed interactions for commanding or important things like that. We use it for learning because that's something you do once. So what we found with timed interactions is that it's either too fast, which means that we'll have a lot of novice users who will accidentally do a command or something when they're just resting their finger on their screen. It's very common to just like read and hold your finger as you're reading. So now you're like invoking random stuff. The other thing is if we now make it the timing longer to solve that problem, it's too long for a task where you want to be efficient. So one example of that is like a Minesweeper game here where they use the press and hold to flag it. So typically you tap to reveal something that's under the tile. But if you want to mark it as flagged because you think there might be a mine there, they solved it with press and hold. So now this is a time-based game. I want to be really fast, but I have to press and hold for every time. And it's just like, it seems like a reasonable thing to do. We used to think about press and hold as the like solution for right-click, but there are actually better ways to do this. And there's just, in this case, examples, you can actually use the touch language. We have a way to select. It's just a swipe down. And now you can, it's just as quick to swipe down as it is to tap, so now you don't have to be slow. But you could also leverage direct manipulation. So you can imagine there being flags here, and you just drag the flag and put it where you want to put it. And now you both avoid the slowness, but you also avoid the accidental invocation. And you actually make a much more engaging experience by dragging and dropping the elements. Visual feedback, it's a key part of how you interact with your content. Make sure that when you press down on something, that it actually gives feedback. And this is something that's really, really easy to forget. I see this all the time. Doesn't seem like that big of a deal, but it really is a big deal. Like, as you use apps all the time, if the button doesn't respond, you don't really know what's going on. It really needs to show feedback, and on down, not after the tap. When your finger is touching something, it should react. We actually have built a whole solution for this for within the system as well to help with that. And right now I'm using these presentation mode visuals so you can see what I'm doing. But if you use the Windows 8 build with touch, you notice that we have these more subtle circles as well when you're not presenting. And this is to show you that your touchscreen is working and really reacting to you. But there are cases where tapping on something doesn't do anything. So if I'm tapping on the start text, I actually know that my tap was interpreted correctly. The start text just doesn't do anything. And then when I tap on the tile, I actually get down feedback to indicate that this item is reacting. So it's really important. Show touch feedback. Anytime you see an app that doesn't show touch feedback, remember this cute kitten. And remember you're punching it in the face. Give touch feedback. Do it. So by leveraging the touch language, you don't have to put extra Chrome on the screen. We have a great way of selecting. You don't need a special mode. You don't need to show checkboxes or anything like that. Just leverage the touch language. Trust us, people will have to learn this to use Windows because you saw, to do stuff on the start screen, I'm going to learn to swipe. So leverage the same thing in your app. So just to show this, news app, notice the nice touchdown feedback. If I want to select something here, I just swipe down the same way. And my commands show up at the bottom. If I drag in from the right side, I get the charms bar. And these are the contracts that we're going to talk about in a minute. And I can just start sharing immediately. So I don't have to learn anything new. I know how it works because that's how everything works. So this is a good segue into reducing the visual command in Chrome because I actually showed most of it already. Might be tempting to put like Chrome here, like these are my things you can navigate into, so I'll show you buttons, like tap on this button to go there. You don't need it. The content is the thing you navigate. Like if I want clearance sale, I'll tap on clearance sale. So instead of having all these remote controls on the screen, just use the content as the thing you navigate with. Another way you can reduce some more Chrome from being on the screen all the time is to use these flyouts. So this is the flyout control. So instead of having like a big text box always on the screen that says, fill in the name of the city you want to add to my weather app, you can actually hide it a level away because you only need it when you say you want to add a city. So I tap add a city, and that's when you show the flyout with what you need. And all our flyouts use what we call light dismiss. So let me show you this one. So there's no close button on this flyout because we made it safe to dismiss it by just tapping anywhere on the screen, and we just eat that tap. So you don't need to have close buttons everywhere. That's something users will learn. Anytime they see something that looks like this box, they can just tap to dismiss it. So that's another way we can use consistency to reduce the Chrome that you need to have on your in your app. This is just another example of how you can actually interact directly with the content. So it's a simple app. A guy runs around, and you just hold on the screen to make him jump and stay in the air. Just use the whole canvas as it. Like, you don't have to have a jump button, because that's the whole screen can do that. So it's very simple. Or you can imagine games where you go left and right, and you just hold on the left or right side to actually navigate. So you don't have to show like buttons all the time. People will learn how to use it. So I already showed you how you can edgy from top and bottom to show commands. So this is a great way to get rid of commands from being on the canvas all the time. So this is my content. This is what I care about. Once in a while, I want to add another feed to my reader. Well, hide it under the app bar. I edgy from the bottom, and I get my commands when I need them. Not all the time, just when I need them. Another important aspect here is that we do have the charms. These charms provide the same services across all apps. So if you have search, you don't need to have a search button either on Canvas or at the bottom app bar because that's a system promise. Search is always going to be on the right side. Sharing is always going to be on the right side, and settings as well. So rely on those to avoid putting those on the Chrome. Just trust on the charms bar being on the right. So a lot of apps are very immersive, and we really want to respect that. Like, we're already giving the app developers the full screen. We got rid of the taskbar and all the stuff that's in the way from the content, so now we have the full immersive experience. So make sure you respect that as well, and use the top and bottom edgy to show the content only when the user needs it. An example as well, you already saw that with the browser. So in this case, the general pattern is put commanding on the bottom, and if you have navigation, put it on the top. So what do you do when you have cases where you have global commands, but sometimes you have contextual commands? Because you saw I selected and the commands showed up at the bottom, right? Well, you place the general commands in the right corner. And then when I select something, we show you the contextual commands on the left. But that doesn't mean you should hide those, because you might as well keep them there because they might be useful. And also, in terms of the mouse invocation, you right-click. So that way, it doesn't matter if I right-click and selected, or right-clicked on the background, I still get all the commands that I care about. So just another example. This is an app. Like, you might have commands. Don't do that. Use selection. Put them all in the app bar, right? So trust the system. Trust that people will know how to use the touch interactions. And the cool thing as well is that if these things apply to multiple items, you actually enable a new scenario now. Whereas before, to like something, I would like everywhere, or to send it, I would tap send, go through a flow, tap send again. You can actually enable multi-item interactions now by showing the contextual commands at the bottom on selection. In terms of navigation Chrome, it's really easy to be tempted to show a lot of navigation Chrome. So this is things that shows the user everywhere they can go. But try to think about it differently. Try to think about focusing on where you are now. Because I'm this place in the app because I care about what I'm looking at, not because I want to go somewhere else. So here's an example of what's very easy to fall into this trap of, like, sure, I have my travel app. I need to show all the important things where people can go, but this is really the content, so now I'm wasting all this space. But this is what's interesting. That's why I went to the app, not to be able to look at everywhere else I can go. And now we might say, what if I put it on the top? Then I can see more content, right? It still takes away the attention from the content. Like, now I don't know, like, is this more important or that? There's so much stuff going on. So now if I instead just flatten it out, it's all about content. It's all flattened out. I can navigate easily, just swiping around with touch or using the scroll bar. But there's really focus on the content here now. There's no thing telling me I should rather be somewhere else, as opposed to being where I am now looking at what I'm looking at. So now you might be wondering, like, I have this huge app. I'm going to put everything on the canvas, but now it's so hard to move around. Well, that's the great thing with Semantic Zoom. Because with Semantic Zoom, you just pinch, and you have easy access to everything. So Semantic Zoom really enables us to create these experiences where we can have a lot of things on the canvas and still have it be just as easy to get everywhere. So you've seen it on the start screen and the other examples. Here's another example of these are my news feeds. All I do is pinch out, and I can actually get easy access. I can go to Swiss Miss, right? So I don't have to have navigational Chrome visible on the screen all the time because I use Semantic Zoom to get there. When you do your Semantic Zoom view, again, Metro style is all about principles. There's a lot of flexibility in what you do here. So these are some examples to kind of get your brain started. But there's a lot of flexibility. As long as you use Semantic Zoom to jump in the list, that's the main thing. That's the consistent thing we need to see all apps following, because that's what users are going to expect. And we showed this in the lab. We made a really cool end-to-end prototype, which is like a lot of different apps. And we had Semantic Zoom in most of them. And people would learn it and use it, and they got to one of the apps that didn't have it, and they got really pissed off. Like, what? It doesn't work. So it's important that all apps follow this pattern. But again, you can really optimize your zoom.view based on what you're showing. So in this case, showing produce or something, I can have a different kind of highlight to indicate that, I don't know, like, if this is my inventory app or something, that these things are doing well, these things are getting a little old. You can use color, you can use typography and infographics to do something really interesting. If it's my list of sci-fi books, maybe actually use some sort of indication of which category do I have the most of. So now I know, like, I don't have that many high-tech things. I have a lot of short stories. You kind of get an overview as well. It's still about jumping, but you might as well give some more interesting semantic information, especially information that helps you decide if you want to jump there. And this is a good example of that, where it could be like your funds. And this one actually shows you how they're doing. So now I know, like, I want to go to the red one and see what's going on. Why is that going so bad? And this one, similarly, when I'm in this view, there's maybe no way to see how many items are in red. But this one actually gives me a nice overview, so I know which one I should jump to. Yes, question. Good question. So can you do multiple levels? So when we tested this, we tried a lot of things. We tried, we started simple, we had two levels, and like, this photo app would be great if I have four levels or I can do multiple things. The thing we saw was that users got really confused because it turns into, instead of being about jumping in the content, it turns into being like a navigational thing where it feels like you go somewhere else. And that kind of reduces the value of Semantic Zoom as a consistent experience across the system. So the guidance for Semantic Zoom is that we only do two levels. It's your 100% view, and then there's the view where you you zoom out a little bit to get a better way of jumping, and that's the main use of it. If you need to do something more complex, you should probably use navigation differently. You should like have a hub that you can drill into content as opposed to jumping within the same canvas. So it's really for jumping on the same canvas. But that said, there's a lot of flexibility here. In this view can be adaptive. If I have, if this view is small, then maybe this has more richness. But if the 100% view is humongous, then maybe I simplify this so I can fit more items on the screen. So like now, since this is for jumping, you don't want your semantic zoom to be 100 pages, because then that's probably why you're wondering, can you have another level? So instead of having another level, what you could do is, so as this list gets really big, maybe I start stacking them. So this one becomes smaller, and I can actually fit twice as many on the screen, but they just have a slight different visual representation.
You showed the bigger and smaller blocks, and I can imagine that some users like it, some users want it differently, or you think you've seen this, and you would like to see it in the representation. So can you change the pictures while being pinched, or is it something you have to do bigger?
Is the question whether you can stay at a different zoom level as you're pinching?
No, right now it's sort of with big numbers.
Yep.
But I want to have this view, but with block size that you showed before.
Okay. You want something more like this? You want something more like this, you're thinking?
Yeah.
In general, we try to simplify, and like, do you really need to be able to change it? Is the question, like, is it really useful? The more commands or options and stuff we add, the more complexity we also add. So we try to keep it simple, and it's really up to you to decide what is the best view for this. And as part of that design decision, you might decide that because I have a lot of days or time periods listed here, I probably shouldn't do the big blocks, because it's really all about jumping. As soon as you get over three pages, you need to rethink your semantic zoom view, because it's going to be too big. Okay, let's talk about fast and fluid. So we did a lot of stuff to remove the adornments and like lines and all that stuff. So a good way to actually add some more life to your content is to use animations, but not use them in a way that's just being flashy to be flashy. Animations actually have a real purpose. They tie the experience together, really tells a story. You understand why what's happening, like why did this panel appear and where did it come from? So to help with that, there's just one example. So imagine if the charms bar just appeared, like it wouldn't look very nice. So instead, it actually has this nice entrance animation. But it's nothing too flashy. If you look at the clock in the bottom, it's really fast when it shows up, actually. Just a very quick fade-in. But it gives you that little bit of a story of where it's coming from. It's like, it's fading in there. My charms bar is sliding in from the right. So in terms of the animation library, because we think it's about being purposeful, we then just like create random animations, like, here's an interesting flip animation or a slide animation. They're really four scenario tasks. So we have the enter page, exit page. So this is really like, you use it when you enter a page and exit a page. And similar like content, expanding or collapsing. So these are really scenario defined animations that you should use in the specified way. So just one more note on panning in terms of being fast and fluid. We really want to make sure our content goes edge to edge when you do this. It could be really tempting to I'll just put a little panning region in here, and then I could put more different things. But it really disrupts the flow, and that's why you'll see a lot of our MetroStyle apps really go edge to edge horizontal scrolling, because it creates a much more fluid, immersive experience with the content as opposed to making it feel boxed in. And as soon as you do this kind of stuff as well, kind of need a box there to show you that this is where this content stops, because now I kind of expect padding to work here or here, but it doesn't. So if you instead go full width, you solve those problems, and the experience just becomes more immersive, and it's all about the content again, and not about containers with content in them. The last thing about being fast and fluid is really about not just, we talked a lot about the visuals and how you can remove lines, but it's also just about the flow and what your app does. And we kind of touched on this a little bit with the more settings you add, the more stuff you add, the more complex your app is. And it reduces the fast and fluid feel of it. So a couple of good examples of what you can do here is you can roam the settings, so the user doesn't have to go and change the settings every time, and it's just automatic. Use our charm bar for a lot of things. So now you actually don't have to create a new concept of search because the user already knows how to search. So that was a lot of stuff about reducing Chrome. There's a lot of techniques we can use, but it's really important to be thoughtful about how we reduce Chrome, how we actually add back that structure to our content. So we talked about the layout structure and typography, which is a good way to do that. Using the touch language lets you remove a lot of Chrome because users will just know how to use your app. You don't have to put them put small aids on the screen so they know what to do. Reducing the visible command in Chrome with the top and bottom app bar, and also leveraging that we have the charms. When you do navigation Chrome, focus on where you are now, not the other places where you should go, and be fast and fluid. So I touched on this a little bit already, but let's talk a little bit more about the contracts. So in Windows 8, we have a lot of features that actually makes it even easier to make your content better. And the first thing to think about is, I'll show you this picture, is that Windows is awesome because it's on all these different devices. It's not just one device. Like, I can have my laptop, can have my Slate, can have my huge desktop. But remember that it's not very useful if your content doesn't look nice on all of them. So we need to think about screen sizes. We also have the different states of the app. So let me show you quickly. You guys have probably played or seen this already, but like there's a full screen state of the app. I can snap it on the side, and I can launch a different app. And it can be side by side. I can make this smaller or bigger. And all these states are things people will use. So we need to think about those. But Windows makes it really easy to support them. And finally, you think about pixel density. As screens are getting better and better, the pixels get smaller, so everything looks sharper. If we don't do something about that, objects will basically get smaller. So there's a solution built into Windows that will scale your objects up. But to do that, we need to make sure that we have the right assets to make that look good. So these are the views. There's the minimum view, which is actually the minimum supported screen resolution for Metro-style apps. And this actually aligns really nicely with when you have a Snap app on the side, because it's exactly the same size. The full screen, which is 1366 by 768 or higher resolution. And these are typically very common. Like, it's just a matter of scaling your app a little bit and then relaying out content and actually leveraging the full space. You want to make sure your app doesn't look stupid and just like has a black bar there, right? You want to go into the full width. The snap view. So the snap view is required. Every app needs to do a snap view. If you don't do work there to make sure it's good, it'll actually just like it will look cut off and it's just going to look silly. So make sure you do work on your snap view. The snap view, we have a couple of things that we do change, like the scrolling direction, because in this one, it's much better to scroll up and down because that's a long direction. And it also avoids conflicts with edgy hair because I'm scrolling up and down, so I don't do accidental edgy from the left. And finally, we have portrait, which is an optional view as well, because our main usage scenario is to use a device and landscape. That's what all laptops will be. That's how we expect people to do most of their interactions. But if your app lends itself to portrait, we definitely recommend that you do work to make sure that it looks good. So like reading mail, reading, all kinds of reading scenarios feel really good in portrait orientation. So like I already mentioned this a little bit about Snap, but if you put work into your Snap state, people will keep your app on the screen. If it's a crappy Snap app, it'll just hide it from the screen. But if they can snap it on the side, there's a lot of really good scenarios. Like you're using your chat client on the side while you're browsing. You watch a movie on the side while you're doing something else. So this is one of the big differentiators and great things about Windows 8 is that we do support true multitasking. So leverage that. So games, there's a lot of interesting examples that we've seen with games where they can actually scale. So it's almost like the game goes into the mobile state of itself. So like you can imagine it's like a little like a strategy game or something where you have targets and it will stretch to the full screen normally. When you put it in the small state, you can still have access to a lot of the content, but maybe it reflows where the score is. So it could be underneath content instead. You can also, it is okay in some scenarios, if your app really doesn't make any sense in the snapped state, what is interesting that you could put in the snapped state? So let's say it's a game, like it's a real-time strategy game or something, and you snap it, you can't really play it in the tiny version, so maybe you show real-time update of scores as other people are playing. And that's maybe why you want to keep it open, so you can track how your friends are doing because you're online playing against them. So we talked about scaling. So a good way to make sure you scale well is by using the fluid layout. So if you're in the smaller screen or the full width, just use a fluid layout. Just have your grid extend the whole way. And this is built into the templates as well. There are some scenarios where you want to do a fixed layout, where, for example, games is a good example of that, where you just stretch the screen. If it's a bigger or smaller screen, you just stretch it because there is no more. Like the benefit of having a bigger screen is so that you can see more content, but that doesn't make sense for games usually. And then in terms of resolution, as your device becomes higher density, things will get smaller, like I said. So a way to solve that is that the system will actually automatically stretch stuff for you. But when you do that, you either need to use scalable vector graphics so it still looks sharp, or you actually need to provide the three assets, and those are the three levels we'll stretch to. So basically, normally you'll probably be at 100%. If someone puts your app on a really high resolution device, a really high DPI device, we'll probably stretch you to 140. So you need to provide an asset for 140%. Otherwise, your app's not going to look good. It will basically be stretched assets. So let's talk about the contracts. So by using the contracts, you can really you can kind of multiplicate the value of your app. You can make your app be available from other apps, and your app actually has the functionality of the other apps on the system. So the more good apps someone has on their computer, the cooler the whole system becomes. So I'll show this with examples, but like search. Now, if you do a search contract, people can search from within your app no matter where they are in the system. They don't have to go to your app first, because all they have to do is swipe from the edge and tap search. And now I can select I want to search in mail. The kind of the embodiment of the contract is really in the charms. That's the most common access point for them. So just rely on those. Like if people want to search, they know how to find search. People want to go to settings, they know that settings is down here as well. So let's talk a little bit more about the contracts. So there's the share contract. So the share contract lets you share something from your app into a different app. And the canonical example is you're reading a web page or something, and now you want to share it on your social network so other people can access it. So instead of having a share button under every article or on the actual Chrome of the browser, you just rely on the share charm on the right. So you just edge it from the right and hit share. So avoid having any other invocation method because Windows provides one. So when you do share, there's this flow that comes from the side that will basically let you finish your share contract. So the thing that's showing here is actually if I'm in the browser and this is my share target, this is the share target drawing the UI because they know how best to share to themselves. So if this is a social networking site, then they would draw the UI. So again, keep the flow simple. Like you don't have to ask a million questions, you're just sharing. Just another example. The next contract that's really important is the search one. So this is typically, you don't have to do search. It might not make sense for your app. It probably doesn't make sense if you're doing a game. But if you have huge collections of dynamic data, you're like a movie catalog or something else, then leverage search so that people can get access to that easily. And again, it's just through the search charm. You just search. You can start typing for whatever you want. And now it defaults to searching in the apps if you don't have a if you're on the start screen or on the desktop. But if you're actually in your app, so like if I go to Internet Explorer and I use the search charm, it actually defaults to search on Internet Explorer. So it's really optimized for the app you're in, but you have really easy access to decide that I searched on Internet Explorer, didn't help me that much, maybe I'll check the Photos app or something else instead. So you can really quickly jump between them, and I don't think this works on my build right now, but you get the idea. You also get some other goodness when you use the search charm, like you get autocomplete. So as people start using the search more, in this case, I haven't used this build a lot, but like you'll get autocomplete suggestions underneath. So you don't have to worry about that. That's all handled by the system. One question we often get is about search versus find. So what's the difference? So search is typically across all your app's content. So you want to, the movie catalog again, like you want to find one movie in the movie catalog app. You don't care exactly where in the app it is, but you just want to find it. Find is all about the current view. So you're on this web page, and you want to find the text string. And that's what you should use find for. When you do find, you actually use it by doing in-app UI. So put like a find option in the app bar. So still tuck it away. You don't need to show find all the time. It's not something users do like every day. If it is in your app, then you need to think about that. But like in the browser case, find is not a main user interaction. So put it in the app bar, and then invoke the app bar to search within the current view. So if you do across all the app's content, then you just leverage the search charm. Find within content is typically something for browsers or like a PDF reader or something like that. So a lot of apps don't really have that kind of functionality. So search and share are kind of embodied by being in the charms bar, but the file picker extension is a little different. But this one's really cool because it really leverages your content and makes it accessible from anywhere. And I actually showed this without talking about it already when I went to change my profile photo. So I'll show it in a second. So basically lets you access your content from anywhere, and it's through the file picker. I'll just show it to you. It's easier that way. So if I want to change my profile photo, I just go here. And then within the settings app, what this button does, it actually just launches the picker. So now the picker doesn't, the settings app doesn't know anything about the apps I have on my system or where my photos are. It just uses the picker. And the picker now has access to the Photos app, the camera app, all the apps actually have content that's relevant. So I want to add something from Photos. It doesn't work right now. Let's see, camera. Great. Awesome. You get the idea. So there's two areas here, right? So there's the top part and the bottom part, and this is all picker, the bluish-green stuff. The stuff that's within that is really owned by the app. So in this case, the camera app, they subscribe to the picker contract and says, I can share content, so you guys should have an access point to me. And then they have that access point in here. And when it's selected, it basically, that app is actually running now, showing all the content it has available. So now because I installed the Photos app or whatever this would be, like my social networking site or whatever, I can actually get to my photos on any other app from within the settings app here, right? So the settings app doesn't have to go and say like, oh, I want to have Facebook and Twitter access or whatever. It just uses the picker. And then any apps you install that use the picker contract will be available to it. And as with all of these contracts, we actually have a lot of help in the templates. So this is another one where you can use the file picker item template in Visual Studio, which gives you a good starting point here with the list view control, which is the most typical way to share content. So this is actually a good example of what I called the basket earlier. So in this case, it's a multi-select scenario. Since I select photos, it actually gives me a representation at the bottom here. So So this is perfect when you do multi-selection, so you know what's going on. And also in case where you might change the scope. So like I'm in this folder now, but I might press go up, and I'll be in a different folder. So if we don't have a basket, I don't know if anything's selected or what is selected. But this kind of gives you a persistent way to see what's currently selected. And this is the way it's split up. So the app is all owns all the stuff that's in the middle. The final contract is settings. So again, we have a consistent invocation point for settings. It's on the through the charms bar. Just tap on settings. And this gives you a quick access point to the most important settings in your app. And then when you tap on something, you own the UI that flies out. But there's a nice way to integrate with this where it's really easy to build this. But basically, all this is the settings you care about and you think are important for your app. But what we give you is a consistent entry point. So you tap on settings, and then this list always looks the same, but you provide the content for the list, and then you provide the actual settings. So again, like, keep it simple. It's fast and fluid is about reducing the concepts. Try to not put settings in there just for fun or because like this one weird guy might like it. Think about what's really useful, because the more stuff you add, the more focus you take away from the other things, right? Another good way to leverage the Windows 8 features is to use the tiles. So these are really the windows to your apps. So it shows you what my app's all about, why I want to go back to my app. So use these tiles to actually provide interesting content. So there's two types of tiles. It could be the default app tile, which is just the normal entry point to your app. But you also have something called content tiles. So for example here, this Facebook thing is actually just a content tile. So this was created through Internet Explorer. So this is Internet Explorer's default tile. But when I was in there, I said, I want to create a content tile from this website, and it was currently on Facebook, so it made a content tile for me for Facebook. So now I get this deep linking access. So I don't actually have to go to Internet Explorer to get to Facebook. I can just go directly to it. So of course, if you want to do these secondary tiles, you need to make sure there's a way to get there. So in IE, it's through a pin command, so this thing. So this way it lets me pin it to start. So that's the typical way of doing it, basically. If you have content tiles, provide a way to pin it. So let's talk a little bit about the last point, which is about giving access to content anywhere. So this is about being connected and live. And one great way of doing that is by having live tiles. So I just showed you these tiles. But it can then be even better by actually providing real and relevant updates. So like you saw in the picture before, you can actually see pictures or anything that's interesting from whatever app it is. It doesn't have to be an icon. The power of the tile is that it can actually show me real, interesting content. You can opt in to cycle through 5 updates. Just think about how you use it. A good example is like a newsreader showing the last 5 updates. Bad example is you have a shopping site with the last 5 days of deals. It's not a good idea to show the last 4 days because they expired. So you have no control when you opt into the 5. Like they're going to be 5 things. So make sure they're relevant. And you can do live tiles, whether they're default or content tiles, and also whether they're small or large. We also have notifications. Notifications are great, but they're great for a certain thing. And they're only great for things that really need to take you out of the context of an app. So it's really like an emergency kind of thing where I'm using a voice IP client, it's running in the background, and I'm browsing the web, someone's calling me, of course it needs to notify me. So it's really for notifications when you're not in the app. So be careful about it though, because there's an easy way for users to disable them. So if you're being annoying, they'll disable your notification, and you can't give them important info. And finally, remember roaming. I touched on this already, but because we all use multiple machines, and we all care about our content, make sure that things, state, and preferences go across those systems. So I don't have to go and change it all the time. And I actually see the content in the same way, whether I use my newsfeeder on one machine or the other one. Be a little careful like with the file size. So it's perfect for preferences, links, small data files. If it's like videos, that's probably not the right thing for roaming. So that's a quick overview of some ways you can make sure your app follows the MetroStyle guidelines. So we talked about reducing Chrome to focus on content and the techniques there, using the Windows contracts and features to make your content even better, and then also make sure that your content is accessed from anywhere. So yeah, use MetroStyle design, and it's going to make your app content shine. So these are just some resources. There's a lot of great resources on MSDN. I just want to call out some of the build talks. So there's the Metro style principles and personality, which is kind of the talk before this, talking more about why do we do things a certain way, talking more about modern Swiss typography and how it influenced us. There's the 8 traits of a great MetroStyle app, which is similar to what I talked about now. There's the designing MetroStyle apps that are touch optimized, which is the talk that Kai did here as well. But if you didn't catch that, I definitely recommend watching that one. Built-in controls, really cool. Definitely worth catching that one. It shows how all the stuff I showed now, all the MetroStyle stuff, is actually built into the system to make it really easy to use it. So if you want semantic zoom, there's a semantic zoom controller, which makes it really easy to build semantic zoom. And similarly, how Visual Studio has the grid and everything embedded into the templates. More info about the search charm and the share charm here. And this one's about scaling and how you can make sure that your app scales beautifully. So that's about it. So yeah, thanks. We're a little over time, but if someone has questions, I'll be here.